Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels. Today on Going Deep, we're going to visit with Tom Talavich and Eric Nauman, two Purdue engineers that are doing groundbreaking work in the field of microconcussions. I think these two guys might be on the fast track to save the game of football. Hey, Tom. Hey, Eric. This is John.
Good to hear you, John.
Hey.
How y'all doing? It's good to hear your voices. So y'all are so great to talk to us. Your ears must burn a lot because we talk about you all on almost every episode of our radio show. Somehow we have a reason to talk about you all. So
interesting.
So we thought it was a great time to just do sort of an update and check in with you guys. And it seems like they're, you know, the conversation is continuing to heat up. So we are going to start the conversation with just some questions about who you are and your background and kind of asking you to talk to us a little bit about microconcussions and how you all got into this in the first place.
Hi, this is Eric Nauman, and I'm a professor at Purdue University. I'm in mechanical engineering, biomedical engineering, and basic medical sciences here.
I'm Tom Talavich. I'm a professor at Purdue University in the schools of electrical and computer engineering and biomedical engineering, and I run our Purdue MRI engineering facility.
Wonderful. Well, Eric and Tom, welcome to Going Deep.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
We are so glad to have this chance to talk to you all again. You have been some of our preferred experts about concussions now for a couple of years. And I wonder if you could catch our audience up on, you know, how did you guys get involved in concussions? You're engineers at Purdue. You know, how did you get involved in concussions and the whole world of sports and head injuries and head trauma?
So, we got involved a little bit circuitously. Eric had always been working for a long time on helmets and was, of course, as a long time and long-suffering Minnesota Vikings fan, always kind of interested in football and the blows that people take to the head and the like. I was working with some faculty on our new MRI facility. We were trying to come up with a way to attack a problem that was out there but hadn't really been meaningfully addressed fully, that we as Purdue and engineers could actually come into it from a different perspective from everyone else. And acting on a tip from a colleague of ours at General Electric Healthcare, we ended up getting into the idea of concussion. He put us on the idea of head injuries. We happened to note that there was a grant opportunity through the Indiana Spinal Cord and Brain Injury Research Fund that was due about a week from the day we were talking to him. And but actually, that was a very funny story. He was on campus trying to show his son. He's a Purdue alum, Jonathan Murray, and he was trying to get his son to come to Purdue. So he brought him down to campus, and we ran into him, myself and Charlie Bowman, one of the other faculty at Purdue, ran into him in the atrium of my building here. And he started talking to us about how we should do this, and he could help out by throwing money at the problem from GE. He was actually trying to impress his son. But we ended up saying, well, wait a minute, I know somebody. And I called Eric, and then Eric said, hey, we should call Larry Leverins down in health and kinesiology, and Denny Miller, the head athletic trainer at the time. And so Charlie and Eric and Larry and myself and Denny all met with Jonathan down in the bowels of Mackey Arena, the basketball arena, for, gosh, a little over an hour, maybe even a couple of hours. And we walked out with a plan to put together a proposal that would be submitted 5 days later.
Wow.
And in the end, as happens in these cases, all the highly detailed and well thought out proposals don't necessarily succeed. But then the thing you throw together in literally a weekend ends up getting a hit, and that's how we got into the general domain. So we started our study that fall, working with the local high schools, and that's been our business for most of the last 10 years now.
Wow, what a story! I think that's called serendipity.
Yeah.
So, and just to follow up on this, the kind of serendipitous journey that you all have been on with concussions, can you all catch our listeners up on how you discovered this kind of phenomena and dynamic of microconcussions in the course of this study?
Yeah, that's another, like you said, serendipitous kind of set of events. We went the extra step. We hadn't really seen this ever done before, but we felt as engineers that you had to have a baseline on everybody. So it wasn't going to do us any good to wait until somebody got concussed and then give them an MRI. So we said, let's look at how they look before the season, and then we'll compare it after they get hurt. And we, let's see, I think we did about 30 MRIs in the preseason.
MRIs.
And we thought, okay, this is great. We got lots of good data. We also gave them an impact test, right, like the computerized test that just about all the athletes get nowadays. And we're kind of, two or three weeks in, we're tracking the hits, we're going to the games, and we're just trying to feel things out. Getting terrified, I'll say, up front, mm-hmm. because up until that point, everybody, all the papers said, well, you get concussed at 80 Gs. And we were routinely seeing kids go 100, 120 Gs, sometimes higher. And I was just shaking that first practice, oh, my gosh, this is horrific.
Wow.
And then the athletic trainer came by and, said, Eric, don't worry about it. Go stand over there. This is fine. This is not a bad practice. And it turned out everybody had been looking at the hits that caused a concussion. They never looked at the hits that didn't cause a concussion. And so if you actually look at those numbers properly, you see that, yeah, actually, that it's a wide range. So about the first 3 weeks, we didn't have anything going on. And finally, Tom says, let's just start bringing people in and see what they look like.
Yeah, part of that, just honestly, is because while I do medical imaging, I understand that medical imaging, especially with MRI and functional magnetic resonance imaging, is a noisy process. So I really wanted to get people in to verify that the methods we'd put in place were going to be reproducible.
Hmm.
So we bring some of the kids in who were taking a lot of these big hits, and they're taking the computerized test ahead of time, and suddenly they're essentially failing the computer test.
Hmm.
And we're sitting there thinking, okay, we probably messed something up because we're not the folks who normally give these tests. So about 6 weeks into the season, we start bringing a couple of those guys back,
mm-hmm.
3-4 weeks after the first time, and they're failing the test again in the exact same manner. And at that point, we finally said, we better look at our imaging data and see what we're getting. And that was when we started quickly finding that the athletes who were failing this computer-based test were also showing substantial changes in their brain health. And that was when we started to realize that, hey, it isn't just concussion. It's all these blows you're taking, all this energy going into the brain. It's having a real effect, and it's having a real effect now in the short term. We've got to start looking at this a little more closely.
Well, this is amazing information, and I think groundbreaking information. And you're doing it at the high school at this time, correct? What high? Are y'all
right.
at West Lafayette at that time?
No, we were working with my high school, Lafayette Jeff.
Lafayette Jeff.
One for us to get hold of, given the fact that their athletic trainers are provided. Well, Clev works a lot with Purdue, and then I happen to know all the people there, so that helped.
right. Well, it's amazing. And so, to be clear, none of these players had what would be diagnosed as a concussion. And it was just the fact that, well, son of a gun, you had all this time and all these baselines and invested in these people, and you weren't seeing any massive concussions, so you thought you needed to measure them again once they weren't passing those tests, and you're realizing the effects of these micro concussions are staggering, really.
Yeah, John, that's exactly right. We go through all this data and we start to see that, you know, over half the team is showing these kinds of changes, but there's no symptoms. And some of the symptoms are classic. Not everybody knows all the symptoms of concussion, but they had nothing. If they were hiding something, it was easy to hide. You know, like it. So that was one of the things that really bothered us, and that sent us off on a bunch of different pathways. My lab started making materials and helmets and trying to come up with new ways to assess helmets, and we kept pushing on this front of collecting data about all the hits that are happening. Moving on eventually to women's soccer, trying to see, you know, what are their gender effects, are there sport effects, that kind of thing. And Tom has been pushing on the front of looking at all the different types of data you can get out of an MRI, which is more than I would say most clinicians ever look at, right? Like that's so he's able to bring a lot more to this than anybody has ever thought to do before. Mm-hmm. You know, the MRI can actually tell you what your brain chemistry looks like. And at that point, you have a very nice picture of the kinds of changes that are happening in these brains without any apparent symptoms.
So we recently had an opportunity to talk with Dr. Lee Goldstein. He's in Boston. You might know his name, but he's a neurologist, and he looking at postmortem brains, you know, has found this same kind of phenomena that brains that show, you know, profound signs of CTE don't correlate with brains that were diagnosed with a concussion, but they do correlate with brains that had cumulative exposure to hits on a regular basis, and that no one, even players, noticed at the time. So they went back in and got more hits and more hits. And so really what you all have found out, what other places have kind of confirmed, is that it's really not about concussion protocols. It's about the way the game is played. And we've talked with you guys before about the challenges that poses when you come, you know, you come into a conversation with such a strong part of American culture. Say a little bit about how your research has taken hold in some places and not, and, you know, kind of how you all have strategized the way to put your work out there.
That's a loaded question. That's a very good one. I like that.
You like how I did that? You like that?
Yeah, very nice, Marcia. A very simple start is to just actually note that we sort of have had to change our imaging protocols since our first couple of seasons, because after our work came out in Sports Illustrated and Frontline and we got, you know, a lot of good publicity early on, we actually have seen a change in how the coaches in the area run practices and play the games. Those first couple of seasons, we had athletes who were taking over 2,000 blows over the course of a 12-week season. And
I don't think we get close to that anymore.
No, the highest we've ever had since then was somebody got around 1,400. Yeah. So we're seeing a substantial alteration. And, yeah, I think it's wonderful. The coaches got the idea and they looked at it and they said, we don't need all those hits in reality. Those aren't necessarily productive. So they're now focusing, at least the coaches we interact with, are clearly focusing much more on how do I teach the kids some skills, and that has a notable, level of reduction on the exposure.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to teach toughness that don't involve hitting your head and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I would say a couple of the things that came out of the early work that were unexpected were we started to get this idea that there are actually some threshold numbers. You know, there's a threshold number of hits, and if you stay below 90 hits of 10 Gs or more a week, you've got a better shot at not showing these huge changes at the end of the season. And what's been amazing, actually, is that over the last, I would say, two seasons of data, we're starting to see that there's actually a threshold magnitude of a hit that causes damage. And the reason that, so it's about 50 Gs, we think. And the reason that's absolutely crucially important is that now I, as a mechanical engineer, I have a design goal. We didn't have that before. And I always said, you know, any idiot can make a better helmet. But you have to know if it's good enough. And so by coupling the sensor research with the MRI work, we're starting to see that there actually is a threshold for damage to the brain. And now I got to be careful I say this, but I'm pretty confident that I can make a helmet that'll keep the vast majority of those hits below 50 Gs. But I needed that design goal.
Well, I can remember a previous conversation that you and I had, Eric, where you said to me, this is just math, and actually, it's kind of relatively easy math. What you guys have said, I mean, this is really kind of groundbreaking information. As a football coach, when I practice from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, as long as players never have 90 hits a week at 10 Gs, you've got a good chance of keeping them away from brain damage. And the magnitude of the hit, you're saying, is 50 Gs. Keep all hits in practice below 50 Gs and keep the number of hits that you get for a helmet in a week below 90, and you really, really have a strong chance at going through a season with a much healthier brain. Is that a correct statement?
I think that's exactly right. And to be perfectly honest, very small changes in, additions of technology, relatively inexpensive stuff could make most of this problem go away. Is that?
Yes.
This doesn't have to be a problem.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is something we're really starting to see as well from when we've looked at across sports and across levels. When we've looked at soccer at the high school level for girls, we looked at middle school football last year for boys, working with a 7th grade team and an 8th grade team in addition to the high schools. And it's very interesting because it turns out that when they're out there on the field, the accelerations that they take, so when they get hit in the head, the resulting accelerations, the distribution of those accelerations was the same across all three of those sports and levels, which is very interesting because it's really suggestive that those are the acceleration profiles that ultimately we've evolved our sports to find acceptable in the context that if you take those acceleration profiles, you tend not to end up with obvious problems now. So I think that's what most of our sports, I bet if we go out and we start working at boys soccer, even though they may take a little bit higher accelerations, I actually doubt they'll be that much higher as a general rule. And even when we go back and we look at our collegiate data, the difference isn't terribly large relative to the high school accelerations, which really is telling us that, we've naturally evolved our sports to the threshold where we don't have an immediate problem. And now I think the question is, can we just evolve the sports to the next level where we don't have a long-term problem either?
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you this. As a football coach, can you help me understand what a 50 G hit might look like? If I want to keep all hits, I know what the number 90 is. Let's keep hits below 90.
Right. 10 G's.
Let's keep 90 hits at 10 G's. But what does a 50 G hit look like? Is that a knockout shot? Is that inside drill? Is that
if you look at the linemen, if they come up and they aren't intentionally using their heads, but they bang around a little bit, there you're talking 30, maybe 40 G, something like that. To get up to 50, you're usually you're seeing somebody with a little bit more speed come at him. Like, I'm thinking of a linebacker, running back, coming to the line.
Like meeting on an isolation block rather than just the yard apart, maybe.
That's a good description. And remember, keep in mind that, okay, that's with current technology, that's a 50G hit. Now, if we actually improve the helmet to absorb more energy, now suddenly a 50G hit, so something that the athlete who's getting hit or hitting experiences is 50G, hey, maybe that now becomes, you know, a tackle or even maybe more than a regular tackle.
Right.
So that's kind of the goal, is to push back, you know, what type of blow actually counts as a 50G hit. Right now, it's kind of a tepid blow, I think you'd argue. Relatively common, relatively standard, and if you really were to say we've got to keep everything below it, it probably isn't football out there right now. But if we could actually adjust the helmets and alter the equipment, alter maybe just a few minor rules, you know, get spearing and the like called more readily or more frequently, you know, you probably can make a 50G hit be a pretty solid play.
You can certainly keep all hits on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday in practice below 50 Gs.
Absolutely.
That's right. There's that. It's a big enough hit that it's you can still have some contact. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. You can still teach tackling. You can still teach blocking, and you're not necessarily going to push it above 50 G.
You know, I'm a little bit like you, Eric. I feel differently about the problem when someone gives me a number. When someone says you're allowed 90 hits, keep them below 10 G. I know what that looks like, other than when someone says to me, well, just don't hit as much in practice. You know?
No, that's exactly right. And that's one of the things that has been great. And I feel like one of the strengths that engineers can bring to this field is we are basically quantifying everything. I mean, probably to a pathological degree, but
otherwise you wouldn't be engineers,
that's
right?
That's why we love you, though.
That's why you guys work at Purdue, man.
Yeah. But the neat thing is that some of these simple numbers start to show up, and you say, okay, keeping the hits below 90 per week, that's actually not that hard. And, you know, eliminating spearing, that technology is completely doable. We can put sensors on them and actually call the penalties automatically if we need to. You know, like that, if you need to take it out of the official's hands, fine. Like, we can do that, and it might take a few games, but they'll figure out that they're costing their team by lowering their head and trying to hurt people, right? Because the game can't be about just going out there to hurt people. It's got to be... It's like the thing that I always thought was wonderful about football was it's basically you're running a chess match in 3 seconds or 4 seconds. You've got to move, counter move, and move again, and so fast and make it all happen in the right way. And that's amazing. That's hard. But that's where I want the challenge to be. Not, you know, can your brain actually sustain the entire game's worth of beating? That's a different game or something.
Right. That's a barbaric game that need to move on from.
Yeah. So you all, you know, that has always made an impression on us that you all have, you know, very doable, concrete solutions. That's why we, you know, John and I both felt the first time we ever met you all and heard you talk about this, like, this is great. You know, they're going to help save the game of football. You know, I mean, because this is a very real issue. It's ruining people's lives. It's creating a long-term epidemic among some of the people that give their lives to this game. One of the other things that Dr. Goldstein said that I really want to hear your thoughts about were that it's really not as much about hits per se, but about jerks and jolts, sudden motion, the brain bouncing around in the head. And I know we've talked about you with you all before about how you really switched up the technology and the engineering of the helmet. Talk to us a little bit about how the helmet technologies you guys have been working with are different than just the helmets that protect your skull from fracturing or whatever.
Yeah, actually, what Lee talked about there, Dr. Goldstein talked about, is correct in the sense that we long ago started emphasizing that we aren't really counting hits per se. Mm-hmm. I mean, we use them colloquially because that's what people use and that's the terminology to which they're accustomed. But whenever we're writing our papers, we always try to emphasize that these are head acceleration events, because ultimately it's that whiplash behavior as well as the direct blow that matter, not just the fact that there was a direct blow. Like, this has become a big issue in the community, because you have a lot of groups that are working on sensor technology to supposedly monitor these head collisions, and they have become extremely focused on, oh, you must use video to validate or verify every hit that you report. But that's really a bad plan, because they end up actually talking about how these sensors are reporting events that do not involve head blows as if that's a bad thing.
They
keep trying to emphasize to everybody, look, it's an acceleration. Your head underwent. Those tissues were stretched. Those tissues were strained. They got moved around. That matters. So that's a really good point, and it's very important to emphasize. So I'll let Eric now pick up the helmets.
Yeah, actually, just to follow that up briefly, like if you see somebody that's maybe not as practiced kick a goal kick, that the shock of really drilling a soccer ball will go right up your spine and give you just a tiny, brief 20G event. You have to be very careful about employing the sensor technology, but it can do so many great things if used correctly. So we focus our helmet designs on sensing technology and energy absorption. So that maybe that's the big difference between in terms of how we look at this. But
would you speak just a little bit about where the sensors are, how they go in,
kind of
stuff like that from A to Z, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of ways that you can do it. People have tried putting sensors in the helmets, but as you know, the helmet kind of moves around a lot relative to your head, so it's not a great indicator.
And there are plenty of sports where you don't wear a helmet.
Yes, exactly. So we've primarily been using these sensors like the X-Patch sensor, where you just glue it behind the ear and it measures the accelerations, and that helps a lot. There's some groups that are trying to make sensor packages that actually go into the mouth that essentially take the place of the mouth guard. And, you know, some people are doing it well where they keep the electronics on the outside. There's a couple groups that are putting the batteries and everything on the inside. And one group in particular that's using lithium polymer batteries, and they tweeted this out a while back, but they're actually putting lithium polymer batteries inside people's mouths.
So that's a Galaxy Note 7 battery, just so you know.
Yeah, and that I can't find anything that says it's illegal, but if not, it's only because nobody ever thought to make that illegal, that it would come to that. So
yeah.
so we keep the sensors on the outside try to take advantage of that data. Very simple measurements, very cheap, very easy. And then we couple that with helmets that are basically double shell helmets. And the idea, Tom put it very nicely, is you get a crumple zone. And it's exactly the analogy of like a 1950s or 60s roadster that's all steel. You know, when that thing crashed, everybody inside was all over the place. And modern cars have a crumple zone, and by and large, you survive crashes now that would have wiped everybody out, 40 years ago.
Hmm.
And it's because you can absorb all that energy in that crumple zone, and the occupants, or essentially your brain, doesn't feel that as much. And you got to keep the energy away from the brain, and that's all. It's a very simple step. It doesn't add any weight to the helmet. It's actually, we can do it for about the same cost, so it is a completely doable step forward. And based on the results we've got so far, except for the most extreme hits, I can keep everything down around 50 genes.
Wow.
I feel pretty confident that this, we can move forward and make this the high-speed chess match that it's supposed to be.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.